This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, I have a lot of stories today. I have one author, but he's got a lot of books, and I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Doug Kelly. Hi, Doug.
How you doing?
Okay, well, right. Doug is sitting here with a pile of his books.
Yes,
my
I
goodness.
Do.
It's great. You know, there are several reasons I wanted to talk to you. One, because I love your book about Alaska. I love stories about people who just are fascinating characters. Mm-hmm. And so often when I read a story like the ones you have in this book, I think there are 27 stories.
Right, right.
Wonderful stories. And each one of them, sometimes I get the idea, I say, oh boy, that story alone would make a great book.
Right, right.
So we'll talk about that. And Doug is also a fisherman.
Yes, I am.
a big fisherman.
I've never caught a small fish.
Well, neither did I.
There you go.
And even when I was a baby, I was catching those big
darn
ones.
Right.
I'd go around
right.
saying, oh, it's so big, it's so big.
And when you're on the radio, they're really big
fish. They're really big fish.
Yep.
And so I love fishing. So what do you want to talk about first? The Alaska book or fishing or
well,
whatever?
You know, we can talk Alaska, I guess, first. You know, I always tell people that from the neck down, I'm in Florida. From the neck up, I'm in Alaska. My body's here, but my soul's in Alaska. And that happens to a lot of people who go there it's the first time there. You hear about different places in the world, and you don't go there, you know, and they're built up in your mind, you're built up, and then you go and it's good, but you're a little let down because maybe, you know, your dreams exceeded your expectations or your expectations exceeded your dreams, one of the two. For me, it was Hawaii. I'd heard all these things about Hawaii, and I finally went there, and it was good. I loved Hawaii, still do. But when you go to Alaska, it exceeds, I don't care what you read, what exaggerations you hear, it is everything you hear and more. And everywhere you look is a postcard. Everywhere you look is a postcard. And it's just the coolness in your face and looking up and seeing loons and hearing them and seeing bears and seeing moose tracks and eating halibut and
oh.
trout and salmon. It's just a treasure. It's just a treasure to go there.
And so when was the first time you went up there?
Well, it's funny. It was following a movie. Do you remember the movie Jeremiah Johnson?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, right at the beginning of it, there's a little opening talk, and it goes like this. And his name was Jeremiah Johnson, and they say he wanted to be a mountain man. Story goes he was a man of adventurous spirit and proper wit suited to the mountains. Nobody knows whereabouts he come from, but it don't seem to matter much. He was a young man, and ghosty stories about the tall hills didn't scare him none. So he bought him a horse and a gun and traps and set out to be a mountain man and said goodbye to whatever life lay down below. And that's how it starts. And that captured me. I don't know why. It just captured me. And then the whole movie was this guy leaves civilization. This is back in the middle 1800s, early 1800s. He had fought in some wars. And he wanted to escape. And he goes to the mountains, hoping to get from the mountains peace and quiet. And of course, what happens? He ends up with a whole different set of challenges and problems and difficulties. And the whole moral of the story is you can't just run away. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, right? Then when you get to the other side of the fence, you find, oh, well, wait a minute, I didn't anticipate this or that. So I saw that movie, and I got in my mind, I've got to go to Alaska. And coincidentally, I had started a security consulting business. And one of the services was mystery shopping. And so I got a contract with some of the cruise lines to do mystery shoppings, where we go aboard posing as regular passengers. Nobody on the ship knows who we are or what we do. And we write a report about people's attitudes, about operations, about integrity, quality of the food, quality of the entertainment, quality of the cabin. And then we furnish a report to that cruise line so they can improve their operation. Well, one of these trips was the Inside Passage in Alaska that would leave from Ketchikan and then go up to different stops all the way up to Juneau and then on up to Anchorage. And it was just so incredibly beautiful. It was stunning. And that started me on my path to going back there as often as I could. I've been to Alaska now somewhere between 35 and 40 times.
Oh, wow.
And I don't plan on stopping.
And so while you're there, you, of course, you know, the wonderful thing about, as I mentioned to you, that my one of my cousins went to Alaska. They went there actually on their honeymoon.
Uh-huh.
They were 19 years old.
Right.
And they went for the honeymoon, and they were supposed to come back to Michigan.
That's the last you heard of them, huh?
Well, practically. I mean, that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
They fell in love with it.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't leave. I mean, they just wanted to be in Alaska.
Yeah, yeah.
And they did actually come back for some of the stuff. But they had just graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it was we had a beautiful June wedding.
Mm.
And they were gone for 2 weeks. And they announced while they were still there, we're staying. my aunt and uncle said no. but they did. They came back after the honeymoon. They were there with us for the mm-hmm. summer.
Mm-hmm.
September, they were back in Alaska, and that's it. They've been there 50 years.
Wow. Well, you know, you can live in the wilderness very close to being outside of a large town like Anchorage or Fairbanks. So you can only be 10 or 15 miles out of town, and there are no neighbors. There's bears, there's moose, there's all kinds of streams for fishing. It's a wonderland. And yet if you need things like hospital care or supplies, you know, you hop in the jalopy and you go into town, get your stuff, so you're not stuck out in the middle of nowhere. Now, if you live hundreds of miles from civilization, you better be pretty hardy. You know, you better be a mountain man to handle that kind of loneliness and to handle that kind of subsistence living.
So when did you decide to start writing a book? You started collecting stories as you met people and hearing about different people, certainly fascinating people.
Yes, that was it. I wanted colorful people, characters, pioneers. I wanted people who were the first to open a wilderness lodge in a place nobody else had done it. Just maybe there was just commercial fishing there, and this person opened up a lodge. And everybody said it's going to fail. It turned out to be hugely successful. Bush pilots who, boy, they've got guts, man. I'll tell you, they're flying when there's whiteouts and you can't tell bottom and top and just trying to fly from instruments and not run into a mountainside. Some of those people and pioneering hunting guides who hunted areas and fished areas that nobody had ever seen before except for Native Alaskans. And also journalists who lived up there and wrote about it and talked about it, lived that type of life, and just a whole different combination of different people. Some of the ones who were involved in fisheries biology and wildlife biology, and it was just a wonderful. It started off like a thousand pieces. How you put those houses together with toothpicks? It was like a thousand scattered pieces, and then eventually it all came together to build this beautiful log cabin. It's kind of an analogy.
Yeah.
That's how it worked. So it was almost 2 years of research, and going there and talking to the families and getting pictures that they had in their archive, not just going to a library or going online and getting pictures everybody else is using over and over and over and over and over again. So that's what it would. That's what it took, and I had my heart in it. I just wanted to do it.
Well, I could tell. Yeah. And it's not always men that you're writing about.
Absolutely not.
I can tell you, as you said, it is a rough country, and you have to really be strong. And so you start, actually, the book with a story about Nellie Neal.
Nellie Neal Lying was 42 years old. She stood 5 feet tall. She was only five feet, and she was 42 years old when she first went to Alaska and became a legend. She became a legend. She started off there not knowing anything really what to do, but she had adventure in her heart. She was a doer, and she got into the food business and started supplying food to the people who were building the railroads at that time. And then she started a roadhouse. So she could put not only feed them, but put them up in rooms. And pretty soon she had 4, 5, 6, 7 of these roadhouses all the way from the Kenai Peninsula all the way up to Fairbanks and Nome and everywhere. And she had confrontations, too. She'd be out in the wild, and she had to run one time. She had to run into her barn and shut the door before a bear caught her, because that bear was going to pound her into the ground.
Well, you know, one of the, I will admit, I don't watch a lot of television, but I do like that Alaska Road one. I think that's, I've always found that so fascinating that they will go out there on those roads.
Icy.
And drive across ice.
Yeah.
You know.
So. Yeah, it's a huge challenge to live there. It really is. And, you know, to be fair, the dark side of it is a lot of people go there, and when in 1 year they realize they can't handle it, and they come back to the U.S. It takes a special person to do it.
Well, Nellie certainly was.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, she was tough.
What a woman.
And she built a museum pretty soon, and she just became a legend in herself. So it doesn't necessarily take some 25-year-old muscular tough guy to go up there and do it. It could be anybody who has adventure in their heart and a love of nature.
So you, when you were doing that research, who did you talk to?
Oh, my. Well, we spoke all kinds of people. I visited libraries. I visited archives where different historical archives were being kept, universities. And I started talking around with a lot of the journalists, too, who covered Alaska, who could point me in the right direction as well. Who are you writing about? You know, who's doing what? Who are the people who are movers and shakers? Not necessarily the political people, but just some of those who are responsible for making fishing and hunting and sightseeing such an amazing experience in Alaska. And those are the people I contacted.
Well, you know, what I love about this whole book is that there are a variety of stories.
Yes, yes.
Which ones stand out to you that right now you want to talk about?
Well, Nellie is one of them. Absolutely. She was incredible. Another one is a guy named Dennis Hay. D-E-N-N-I-S H-A-Y. Dennis lived in Washington, and he's one of the many who lived in the lower 48 during the winter, and during from spring until late summer would go up and have businesses in Alaska. And he started a wilderness lodge in a little place called Elfin Cove, which is west of Juneau, about 100 miles. And I think it's a Chinchakoff Island, which has more brown bears per square mile than any other location in the world. And you thought to think, this guy's got to be nuts, you know, to build a place out there. And he did. He was a big guy, like 6'2", 6'4", stocky, had a gray beard. And, you know, at the beginning I talked about how he had the adventurous spirit in wit suited to the mountains. This guy was a perfect mountain man. And he built this place from scratch and knew how to market. And he marketed this place as a sightseeing hub, a fishing lodge, hunting, and it was fabulously successful.
Well,
and he's an interesting character in there. And another one is a guy named Chris Batten. Chris Batten was a writer, and he would hop on bush planes and go to areas that no one had ever, that there was no record of anyone ever visiting. And he would fish. He wanted remoteness. He'd get dropped off at a lake 300, 400, 500 miles away from the nearest road. He'd get dropped off there and then not get picked up for 2 weeks. And he had to take the supplies out there to make it, to build his own domicile, to not get eaten by bears, to catch fish, to make fires, to do the whole thing and just go out there and be a mountain man for 2 weeks. And he loved it. He loved every minute of it. He hated coming back.
Yeah. Did you ever do that? Get dropped off and said, pick me up?
I did. I did it on a short trip. It was a four-day trip, so it was a lot reduced. But it's scary because they have a rule there. It's called the 25 rule. And that is, if you see 25 bears over the course of time that you're there, 24 of them are going to be fine. They're going to see you. They're going to be more scared of you than you are of them. They're going to run away. But there's that one bear, that 25th one, probably a young male, that says, you're not pushing me. I'm not running away from my territory. You're going to get out of mine.
Uh-huh.
And they'll confront you, or worse. And that's where you hear a lot of these bear stories, where people are out hiking. And it's not necessarily they catch a mother with cubs, although that's dangerous. It's a lot of times it's a territorial thing. They don't want you there. So that's always a big concern.
So I wouldn't do it. I can tell
you. Well, you know, they have fly-in tours now.
Yeah.
You go with a guide. And there'll be 8-10 people, and you'll go with a guide who usually has a flare. And they found that flares scare the bears more than the horn does, or bear spray, or whatever. These flares come out, just like the ones you see on 4th of July.
Uh-huh.
Shoots out bolts, you know?
Yeah.
And evidently, those scare the hell out of the bears that they take off. So you have a guide with you who could do that, but nobody's armed. And you'll get up within 10, 15 feet of a 1,000-pound bear. And these bears are wild. These are not in cages. And it's a scary experience at first. It really is. But that's what Alaska's all about. It's adventure.
And you're a brave guy.
It's adventure, and it's not for the faint of heart. It really isn't.
But it's obviously worth it for just as you said, the sheer beauty,
yeah,
and the amazing vistas that you see, the amazing things that you see. It's quite a fascinating book. I think that a lot of people will find it so interesting. As I said, I love these stories. For people who have not been in a bush plane, this alone is an adventure.
Oh, yeah. And they've all crashed. You will not talk to a bush pilot who has not crashed at some point in time. One guy I mentioned, he had 9 crashes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that's like a cat's life. You know,
yeah.
you're every time you go down, you might come up again.
Yeah, because it is rough.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
The weather can turn nasty. And when they have those whiteouts, when everything looks white, the ground, whatever, even with instruments in your plane, you can be flying and you think you're going over the treetops and you'll run right into a mountainside.
Well, tourism in Alaska is so, I think it's one of the biggest industries there.
Oh, sure.
You know, and,
yeah.
And it's a wonderful place to go. And I think that this book, which is called Alaska's Greatest Outdoor Legends, Colorful Characters Who Built the Fishing and Hunting Industries. This is a great book,
yeah.
A wonderful book. I think it will inspire a lot of people to get up off their tushes and get out there and have some real adventures,
yeah.
and see these beautiful, magnificent things. And isn't it just so crazy that Putin has his eye on Alaska.
He's not going
to get it.
No. There's no way. They thought we just bought a big chunk of ice back in the 1850s or 60s. And now they're all kicking themselves for making that mistake.
Yeah.
I think we bought it for $7 million.
Yeah.
Some such thing.
Well, it was Sewell's Folly, and it's...
Seward's Folly.
And so it's just wonderful that... we got it, and it's ours, and we love it, and that's it.
That's pretty much it. And I tell you, when you're out in a boat, like Dennis Hay had a 30-foot boat, he had a skillet in his boat, and we would go out and catch salmon or halibut, and he'd cook it right there on the skillet. And that, talk about fresh, right? And meanwhile, while you're anchored there, you're hearing loons flying over. You see on the side of one of the mountainsides there, you see a family of bears. You can see moose tracks on the side, on the other side of the water. There's orcas, you know, breaching and swimming around. You're looking at glaciers, and you can't believe it. It's like a dream.
Well, everybody, you get this book. It's called Alaska's Great Outdoor Legends, and it's coming up to the holidays. And if you're looking for a gift book, this is a perfect book.
Really
great. Now, we're going to take a break, and I'm going to play a book buzz from Devon Miller, and then we're going to have some commercials, and we'll be back. And then we're going to talk about fishing, okay?
All right.
Because
All right.
we love fishing.
We'll
okay.
do it.
We'll... All right.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Lock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Do you want to have a playtime adventure? Why not have it with chicken? Or should I say, con pollo? Meet Pollo, a friendly chicken who wants to play all day. Pollo is the character from the book Con Pollo, a bilingual playtime adventure. The book was written by host of The Tonight Show Jimmy Fallon alongside Jennifer Lopez. The book was illustrated by Andrea Campos. A New York Times bestseller, this was Jennifer Lopez's first children's book and is dedicated to Jimmy Fallon's high school Spanish teachers. Con Pollo, a bilingual playtime adventure, serves as an introduction to basic Spanish vocabulary to young readers as you decide what fun to have with your new friend, Pollo. The idea of the book came from Jimmy Fallon and Jennifer Lopez wanting to partner up and do something together. After various ideas, they settled on writing a children's book together. During the pandemic, people were getting chickens as pets, which sparked the idea for a book with chickens. And of course, the design of Pollo came from the illustrator Andrea Campos, who couldn't believe she was offered to illustrate the book. When Andrea was on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy gifted her a stuffed Pollo plush. If you ever get your own plush of Pollo, maybe you could continue to listen to Joy on Paper, con Pollo. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With my guest here in the studio, Doug Kelly, and he was just typing away along with the music.
My fingers were moving.
That's it, because he's a busy guy. He's always writing a book. This is so exciting. I know you've got a new book coming up.
I do.
And we're going to talk about that after a while. But I just wanted to say, you're a military brat.
I am indeed. My dad was an Air Force pilot.
Okay. What did he fly?
Well, during the war, he flew P-51 Mustangs, and he flew with the RAF. And so he was doing raids over France and Belgium just before D-Day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And my husband trained on a P-51.
Yeah, cool.
It's a long story how it got to Israel, but my husband was from Israel. Uh-huh. And that was one of the planes that he trained on.
I'll be darned.
And he, as a matter of fact, that is his... It was always his favorite plane.
Oh,
when,
yeah.
Once you're in a P-51, that's it. That's your dream plane.
Yep.
And we flew later on. Of course, we also lived in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew out of an RAF base,
yes.
White Waltham.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a Cessna there. We didn't own the whole thing. We owned a quarter of it. Basically, 1 week a month, it was ours completely, and we flew all over. Of course, we flew to mostly to Edinburgh. That was our favorite destination because why did we fly to Edinburgh? Because we had friends. Well, we would drive over to the coast where they had a smokehouse for commercial smokehouse for salmon.
Oh boy!
So we would fly. We would eat salmon all weekend.
Oh man, that's delicious,
isn't it?
Yes.
And trout too, because then we do a little of our own fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't for people who don't know fishing? I feel sorry for it. Fishing is so wonderful. As I mentioned to you, I was fishing before I could walk. My dad put a pole in my hand, and there was a place in Upper Michigan. We're called Upers, and there was a spot there under Red Rocks. It was a sort of a cliff, and it was called Red Rocks. And then just below that, there was this fishing spot where you could just throw it, and you would get a fish.
Every time, huh?
Every time. Mm. So it was something that I remember from my childhood. So tell us about your love of fishing.
I sort of picked it up from my dad. I also picked up golf from him. I played golf and then fishing. And he'd take me fishing at times. At first, I just caught like small fish for his bait so he could do it. And then pretty soon, I started fishing for what he was catching. And we were stationed in Florida for a while over up in Panama City and Patrick Air Force Base. And then Homestead Air Force Base, too, down south of Miami. So we were going out in the Gulf Stream, and we were fishing, offshore for sailfish and dolphin and wahoo and whatnot. And then we'd fish the reef for grouper and snapper, and then come in and fish for bonefish and permit and tarpon. So I had the whole thing. He liked to fish all different styles, so that's how I started off.
And so that's led you right into a whole big career here of writing for fishing magazines, and t- Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, when I was living in the Keys, I lived down there after I got out of college. And in the Keys, I mean, everybody fishes. You know, it's the Keys are, if for those who don't know, is a string of islands south of Miami that start in Key Largo and end in Key West. It's about 90 miles of different islands connected by little bridges. And you're really, not a lot of people were fishing back in the 70s and 80s down there. And we had a boat. And so we would go out in the boat and fish from morning to night. And it was just fun. You know, it was fun to do. You take some Kentucky Fried Chicken and a cooler full of drinks. And you go out and you make sure you have a top so you don't get burnt, you know, from the sun. And when you're not fishing, you just go to a little cove that's sandy over by Flamingo and just run around the beach a little bit. And it's just a nice release. That's how I got into fishing.
Well, you know, with your Hemingway looks, do yes. you ever enter that? People who can't see, Doug looks a little bit like Hemingway. Do you enter the Hemingway competition?
I never have. They have that every year in Key West, the Hemingway contest, and I haven't as yet, but I'll have to try it.
Well, you should try it. Yeah. You do pretty good imitation of Hemingway.
See, I'd rather people think that my writing looks like Hemingway, but my face doesn't look like anything like it. I've got it backwards.
Well, I don't know. I think you're a great writer because, as I said, with your Alaska book and you're telling the stories of interesting people, you're a darn good writer.
Well, thank you.
So with the fishing, what is your fishing book?
Well, what happened is when I was down there, there was a business meeting. I was sitting next to a fellow who was starting a weekly paper, and I said, "Do you have a fishing writer yet?" And he says, "No." He says, "Do you have experience?" I said, "No, but I'm a pretty good writer." He says, "Well, let's try it. Send me a couple of articles." So I did, and I started writing for this weekly down there. And then after 6 or 8 months, I got a hold of one of the magazines, Saltwater Sportsman, and I sent a query to them, asking if they would like an article about how to catch bonefish at night. They did, and that's what started that. So that's how I started getting into that. And then pretty soon I was offered a job at Florida Sportsman magazine as a managing editor on staff. So, and they were in Miami, so I just commuted from the Keys to Miami. And then from that point, I left them and became editor of another fishing magazine called Sport Fishing, which was based in Winter Park near Orlando. And ever since then, I've pretty much freelanced. I was writing about fishing for the Tampa Tribune when it was still around. I've done some articles for the Tampa Bay Times. But I was doing books too. I did this, my first book was Florida's Fishing Legends and Pioneers back in 2011. And as a journalist, and as someone who was writing also for new magazines and newspapers, I got to know a lot of the star anglers, some of the so-called legends of fishing. And by doing that, I was able to put together a book similar to the one I did with Alaska, where each one's sort of a mini biography of somebody who has shown they're an expert at angling, and not just about fishing, but their exploits, you know, their trips to Costa Rica, funny things that have happened, tragic things that have happened, great things that have happened. So it keeps it upbeat and fun. So that's how I got into writing. And through that, my love of fishing is endured.
Well, and that is something fishing, I love it so much. Yeah. As I said, I would do it since I was a child, and I never forget the first time my husband didn't know how to fish, and I took him to a place in Quebec, Blue Lake, Quebec. Mm. Fantastic place. And he didn't know I fished. Mm. I mean, he didn't, you know, we lived in Europe, and he didn't know I fished. And I was, you know, a London person, so he was surprised when I said, "Oh, we're going to Blue Lake." A friend gave us a cabin, and I said, "Well, we're going fishing." And I woke him up. He had no idea I was going to do this. I woke him up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I said, we're going fishing. He had never fished in his life. And I said, they're going to be biting. Believe me, they're hungry, and we're going to be out there. And you know that, isn't it magical when you go out on a lake, and it's that early morning?
Smooth water.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Mm. And you know they are down there, and they're going to bite.
Yeah.
And he was so surprised when they started biting, and I was, and for the entire week, all we ate were fish fried in butter. Isn't that a wonderful feeling?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's nice. Did he become a fisherman after that?
Well, yeah, after that.
After that, he got the fever, right?
Because once you do it, and it's, but that special fresh fish cooked in butter is like, It's nothing like it.
That's heaven. I remember I was doing an article for Florida Sportsman, and a girl wanted to come on the trip from a PR company. She set up the trip, so to speak. So she wanted to come anyway, but she was anti-fishing. She thought it was torturing fish, and you don't have to do that, and you can buy fish at the supermarket and all this stuff. And just, you know, I couldn't... We didn't really fight her with it. We just said, no, it's really a fun experience. You know, it really is. Well, she was like that. If we get on the boat one day and we see some bonefish, and just for grins, I said, here, throw this in. Oh, I don't want to do it. She throws in, hooks up a bonefish. And if you've ever played a bonefish, they're like lightning going across the flats in the flat water. It's the line has a rooster tail behind it. That's how fast they're like that through the water. She was thrilled. She's saying, oh, I can't believe how much fun. Oh, my God, I love this. And this is someone who had all these bad things. Well, guess what? After that, she wanted to fish every day. Every day she wanted to fish.
I believe it, because it is so much fun.
Yeah.
And much, much better than opening a tuna can.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And you always have that wonderful thing. It's like a treasure hunter. You never know for sure. You know, when it pings, what's going to be under there? Is it a piece of junk? Is it a silver real? And in fishing, you don't know, because, you know, lots of times you can't sight fish and see the fish. You're fishing deep, and you're not sure what's going to bite. And you have that, you always have that hope and that thrill when you pull something up and it's a grouper or a snapper or something really good to eat.
Yeah, it is exciting. And when I was a kid, we fished because we were poor. And you know, living on Lake Superior, I would think we ate fish maybe 3-4 days a week, mm-hmm. because it didn't cost anything.
Yeah, right.
And it was great. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful diet, actually.
Yeah, so it was good subsistence.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think more people should try it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's fun, and it's lean and fat, and it's got a lot of protein.
Yeah,
And it tastes great if you prepare it right.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you're fishing too, it does something to relax you. Mm-hmm. You have that moment of excitement when you catch something, but when you're not catching, even when you're not catching. You breathe differently. I feel like you're just in a different world. It's wonderful.
It's stress-free. You know, you're away from all your problems. You're away from traffic. You're away from newspapers. You're away from politics. You're just out there, and the fish has no reverence for you. They don't care if you're the President of the United States or a garbage man. You know, either you have the skill to catch that fish or you don't. And it's a great equalizer.
It is. It really is. It's lots of fun.
Yeah.
Now, I want to play another book buzz, because it's just here before the holidays. And this is a great book for anybody who loves sci-fi. And Bria Burton has done these wonderful, wonderful book buzzes for us to really get people interested in sci-fi. So we're going to play that book buzz. Then I'm going to come back and let's talk about... You wrote an autobiography.
Yes, okay, I shall.
We'll be right back. Okay. We'll just play this one book buzz.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2022 release in ebook. Ruthless Positivity by Avery Blake. Now, let's download the book bundle. When hacker Cam establishes her online persona inside a virtual reality called Escape, she programs her own upgrades, raising herself up from real-life poverty to become a wealthy business owner inside the virtual reality. But if anyone in or out of Escape finds out that everything Cam has comes from her hacking skills, in other words, it's all stolen, her chronically ill body in real life will be arrested and imprisoned for what little time she has left on Earth. Her only hope is to perform a risky, never-before-accomplished hack that would upload her conscious permanently into Escape. Enter Lyle, the handsome and famous son of Ruthless Positivity creator Julia Grace, a self-help icon who spouts ridiculous idioms that everyone inside and out of Escape seems to drink up like Kool-Aid. Before Cam's mentally ill father died, he emotionally abused her with the same jargon sold by Ruthless Positivity. Cam battles her attraction to Lyle while witnessing his unhealthy, codependent relationship with his narcissistic mother, Julia Grace. A warning from Cam's AI assistant means she's running out of time, and Lyle might be the only person she can risk trusting in the real world and the virtual world. This fast-paced standalone novel will keep readers turning pages as the clock ticks down on Cam, her disease-ridden body like a time bomb waiting to destroy all her hopes of living a blissful existence in Escape for all eternity. Author Avery Blake is obsessed with all things sci-fi. She writes stories about the things that fascinate and occasionally terrify her, and the potential futures humanity might have. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
Okay, thank you, Bria. Another one wonderful, wonderful recommendation. And I am here in the studio with Doug Kelly, and we are going to talk now about your autobiography, because one of the things is, this is November, it is NaNoWriMo, which is the National Novel Writing Month, and many of my listeners are writing for the first time in their lives. They've decided to join in, and I've been getting wonderful emails from them. The idea of NaNoWriMo is that you write a book in 30 days, November. Every November they have this, and you write a 50,000 word book in 30 days. And it's a challenge to get people writing, to get them actually living the dream that they've been dreaming about. And so many people do. They say, oh, I'm going to write a book, I want to write a book, and they don't. And so NaNoWriMo was established with that idea in mind. And if you get to 50,000, you are a winner. And a few years ago, my goddaughter, Kanisha, challenged me to do it because she had done it a number of times. And I did it. I did, well, actually, I did it in 26 days because that year I had a big Thanksgiving to cook. And so I knew I didn't have the luxury of waiting to the 30th. So I finished in 26 days and I wrote 50,000 words.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yes.
It's a lot. But the idea is get it down on paper and you can go back and you can revise it, you can change it, you can do it.
Sure.
But it's the point of getting this habit of writing.
Sure.
So you decided to write an autobiography, and we got to mention a little bit about your dad, which is a fascinating. But as you said, you lived in many places. So what was the idea when you decided to write this story about yourself?
Well, I always had an abiding interest in politics, and going through college, I was helping local campaigns in Miami when I lived there. My dad had retired at this point from the military. I was going to college, and they had college campus Republican clubs all throughout the state, about 25 different universities and junior colleges, they called them then. Now they're community colleges. And I was chairman of the college Republicans. And so I got an abiding interest in that. And, you know, when you're young and you're overly ambitious, you sometimes make stupid mistakes. And I was approached by a guy named Donald Segretti, who turned out to be the dirty trickster of Watergate.
Yes, I was just going to say.
And he talked me into, and I was, you know, when the election's over and Nixon's in for the second term, we're all going to do this, that, you'll be have a job, and blah, blah, blah. So I bought into it. Now, I went along with that, I did a lot of little capers. I'm the only one of three people who testified before the Senate Watergate Committee on the dirty trucks tricks. Don did it, I did it, and one other guy who were mainly involved. I didn't do anything illegal, but it was unethical, you know, stuff that I did. So I decided after that, well, wait a minute, I'm going to turn my life around here. I'm going to start a security consulting firm, and one of the things I'm going to do is work for corporate companies by planting investigators into their company as regular employees. Mystery shopping, you go on, you act as a regular customer. Undercover investigations, you actually pose as an employee for 6 weeks or 8 weeks in a company. So that's what I was doing. I was doing that. I was licensed and insured. I had 17 employees. It was going great in Miami. And I decided, as one of my other things that I was going to do, was become an expert, a world's expert, in locating listening devices, clandestine listening devices, transmitters, microphones, telephone taps, all that stuff. I learned everything. I went to different seminars, schools, whatever. I acquired the equipment. And I was going around the world looking for bugs. And it was quite adventurous. And some of the people that I ran into who I did work for was Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, President Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines at the time, Bob Hope, lots of political people, lots of celebrities, mainly for corporations, mainly for Fortune 500 companies. So this whole book it's called Dirty Trickster Corporate Spy. A Watergate saboteur switches from disrupting campaigns to spying on employees. And that's what this is all about. And it's pretty comprehensive.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and it's sold very well. It's put it out in 2018. So I usually tell this to people, and they say, God, I would have never figured that out about you. But that was 50 years ago when this took place. And obviously, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't, because that's not what politics should be about. But it was quite interesting, the people I dealt with in the White House during that time, with Don, and thereafter, how it got me into corporate security and the good guy end of it was quite fascinating.
Well, who's bugging Bob Hope? They wanted his most recent jokes.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, a lot of it's when you're under an investigation for taxes, or you have a criminal charge against you, or you think people may be interested. For instance, Frank Sinatra was paranoid that the FBI was listening in on his calls. He got me the job with Dean Martin. Dean Martin didn't want to do it, but Frank talked him into it. And so it was interesting meeting those people, you know, in person and doing something for them like that. But it made for a good book.
It sounds like, yeah, it. Boy,
it
oh boy!
Good book.
We have to promote this one.
Yeah, yeah.
And you worked for the Marriott Hotel.
Yes, when I was prior to getting into the fishing, writing and whatever, full time, I was working for a security company called Marriott Security Systems, and they were a wing of Marriott Corporation. And my job was to do investigations for Marriott at all their properties, their hotels. At that time, they had an in-flight business where they provided food to the airlines. They don't do that anymore. Their theme parks that they had. So I was very busy. So I was doing corporate security from that standpoint.
Well, just last week I had Gary Grossman, who was with Marriott Hotels for 30 years, mm-hmm. and he was talking about how so often the hotel rooms, especially in the big cities where there would be conferences, would be bugged.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they found a lot of bugs, like in, you know, Vienna and Tokyo, and and it's hard to believe, but yes, they really are bugged.
Well, you wouldn't think they were, but you got husbands bugging wives bugging husbands. You've got employers listening in on employees. You've got employees listening in on employers in some small cases. You've got companies that are bidding against other companies that want to know what their bids are like, trying to find out what they're doing. Then you've got your foreign spies trying to bug and steal our domestic secrets and our military secrets. So you have police departments that are conducting not necessarily legal taps and bugs, but they can't use that to build a case because it'd be thrown out, but they could still use it to build their case without saying that they were doing taps. And there's legal taps where the judge goes for it. So it's a lot more than people realize.
So does it really work like they show in the movies, turn on the radio when you're talking?
Well, yeah, it's called masking. And they even have white noise devices that create noise. The best thing to do is to go in the bathroom and turn the water on, and you both sit on the rim of the tub.
And
that's the best place to
do it. Okay, people, this is advice from an expert
who knows
about bugging.
Yes, I do.
Okay, this is fascinating. And the name of that book?
That is called Dirty Trickster Corporate Spy. This one's under my first name, Martin D. Kelly. My middle name is Douglas D. Kelly. And Alaska's Greatest Outdoor Legends and Florida's Fishing Legends and Pioneers. They're all available on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and lots of online and brick-and-mortar stores.
Okay. And the new book is coming out sometime in the spring?
It'll be out around April or May. And
okay.
It's going to be called Sunshine State Mafia, and it'll be a history of the mafia in Florida from the 1920s all the way up to now, this time.
And that will be coming out under the name of?
That's being published by the University Press of Florida.
Okay. With your
under
other
Doug
name?
Kelly.
Under Doug Kelly.
Under Doug Kelly.
Okay,
so
great.
Martin Kelly or Doug Kelly, those are my names.
Okay, well, Doug Kelly, it's been a joy to have you in the studio with me today.
I've enjoyed it.
I think it's wonderful. You're a great writer. And people, you have to read these books. They're really fun. And I will put them up on my website this weekend.
Cool.
And I want to thank you so much because I think it's just wonderful that people look at this, what you can do when you're writing. You have so much fun, don't you?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The creativity is what it's all about. That's why we also do a radio show. It's a different form of creativity.
Oh, yeah. Mention your radio show.
Yeah. My wife and I have a show called The Kelly Kelly Show every Monday from 5 to 6 right here on the TAM Talk Radio Network.
And what do you talk about?
Well, we're kind of a community asset, you might say. We talk about business owners.
Okay.
And everybody else, and you're running out of time.
Somebody is playing music because, as I always say, thank you, Big Ed in the control room. It's always great. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him because I should have been a general. And everybody, have a wonderful, oh my goodness, it's Thanksgiving. Have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving Day. I'm going to be playing a repeat of a very wonderful program from a general, actually. And
cool.
Everybody have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And Doug Kelly, thank you for being here today. It has been a real joy to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Oh, we're out of here, Doug Kelly. We're out of here.